Yo. Can you hear me? You listening to
What a week. Ata, welcome to another episode of Wow, What a Week. This week, we are hanging out with a mover, a shaker, and one of the young faces of the government of national unity, and one of a handful of ministers under the age of 40. So yes, you won't see him passing out in Parliament. He's coming up next.
This is
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Celebrity guest.
Celebrity guest.
The first conversation I had with this young man, as it were, the Honourable Minister, was when I was at 5FM. I think at the time he was working for the Western Cape government, and there was a program where drunk drivers were to be named and shamed. Jiggy Jiggy, he's gone. He's doing something else. Then the other day, I'm like, hold up, he's now a minister. What is this? But many of you would say we're not surprised, because he's always been that guy. He knows what he wants and he goes for what he wants. Please make some noise for Minister Soli Malatsi.
Thank you for having me.
Minister, welcome.
It's truly a pleasure to be here. And as I was telling my spokesperson, Gwena Moloto, that my very first real live interview as a very, very young spokesperson at the time was when you were on 5FM. So
yes,
this feels a bit like a full circle in terms of media engagement.
For me, it feels like you're back to say, look what I'm doing now.
No. Look, I mean, I could take that, but that's never the approach. It's just fascinating how life, you know, eventually works out. Because at the time when I was the spokesperson for the MEC of Transport and Public Works, we're basically looking at how do we aggressively showcase to people the dangers of drunk driving and that there are real consequences.
Mm.
And when I think back to that moment, I did not see this path. You know, I'd always wanted for the largest part of my life to be behind the scenes.
Oh, yes.
But you can never hide from your calling for a long time.
I was going to say, often our work ethic and the trail we leave speaks for us anyway, whether we want to or not. So your work ethic is going to put you in rooms you don't want to be in. So sometimes stay under the radar and be mediocre so that no one notices you. Or be like you and kick butt, and this is what happens.
And it's very interesting because, I mean, there's a Xitsonga saying, and my wife is Tsonga, so that's the influence there. That says, mintiro ya bola bola.
Exactly.
Which basically means actions speak louder than words.
Mm.
Because the credibility of your work,
you're
correct, opens doors, unimaginable doors for you.
Sure.
And in politics, that can also be a disadvantage, you know, because in politics too often, those who scream the loudest, those who declare their ambitions, you know, in the most bold manner, become the populists who then get the numbers, you know, and the guys who just want to do things the right way, often don't get elected in a way. And I think we're also seeing a shift in politics where there is a different generation of leaders that are emerging, and perhaps this is what will restore the country's faith in our politics, because if truth be told, a lot of South Africans have rightfully given up on politics as a way to influence society and to make society better.
In fact, let's start with the five-year-old. You're Minister of Communications and Digital Technologies.
Yeah.
How would you break that down to a five-year-old? What do you do?
So, basically, I'm the guy who oversees policy making in communications and digital technologies, covering broadcasting, postal issues, regulation of the media, and also looking in terms of access to connectivity, making sure that South Africans have access to internet connectivity.
Sure.
And that it's not just access, but it's meaningful access.
Mm.
And we also have a responsibility of looking after 11 boards. There are 11 entities that are under the Department of Communications, ranging from Post Office, CENTEC, which is responsible for signal distribution, and the South African Broadcasting Services. So my primary responsibility with those is to ensure that they are properly led by having boards, the management, and that they do the right things, which is not always easy.
So before the government of national unity, and had the GNU not happened, where do you think your trajectory would have you at this very moment?
I would probably be, you know, in parliament as one of the opposition, on the opposition benches, probably one of the prominent voices in the DS, the official opposition, primarily because in the previous parliament, I was one of the whips. So the whips are the senior leadership of any party in parliament. So I'll probably be that. Yeah.
So let's go to that fateful week of negotiations.
Yeah.
Where were you during that week and what role did you play?
So I think we'll break it down into three sets of weeks.
Okay.
The immediate week after the elections, the election results, where I think a day before the official elections, a trend was emerging that no one has a full majority.
Yes.
And that the scenario that it was leading into would require the ANC and the DA to talk to each other. At that time, at that time, there was indications from the senior leadership of the party that we needed to then send feelers, know, to the ANC about the need to have a conversation. And it felt like it was a very short period, but it was a very long period of anticipation.
Yes.
Then, you know, sussing out meetings were happening. The official results then.
It felt like a courtship.
Yeah, it was.
Like, I've known you from across the room, but it looks like we might have to stay together now.
Yeah, and Nehonale Guababa, you know, in the initial stages, you know. So because I think initially no one wanted to make the first move.
Yes, yes.
Right? And then when the picture was clear.
Is it no one wants to make the first move because of the uncertainty, or was there a bit of arrogance from both parties that they must call us?
No, I think, I mean, and I'll speak on behalf of the of the DA. I think it was, let's have a clearer sense of what we want to do first, right? So that if
let me tell you what I'm bringing to the table first.
You know, and be certain of what I'm bringing.
Yeah.
Because organizations are also very complex, because there are internal structures that need to be consulted along the way. But the leadership must go to the rest of the organization, at least with a preliminary proposal. Yes, otherwise, you're just going to be, you know, thrown into all directions. So in that first week, the most important thing was we need to establish a team of our negotiators. Right, so that we can have people that lead the conversation. So that what we did then as the DA. The second week was, it was clear that the ANC was also setting up its own negotiation team, find time to negotiate with actually the real people also, because there are people who are representing themselves as claiming to represent the organization.
You know, it's always the case. And I think it's like that in politics, even at local government level. I'll just give you a funny example. Yeah. You go to an event, you'll meet a guy who'll tell you, yeah, no, it's very mayor.
Yeah.
When I set up company, like it's very mayor, and then maybe it's like answer.
Look, there are a lot of chances.
Yeah.
And the lower you go, the more prominent they are.
Absolutely.
Right? But sometimes it's also just lobbying. You know, people first want to, before they send their senior leadership, send people who suss out the temperature first.
Sure.
So that second week was, you know, one, the logistics of having our negotiation team meet with the ANC team. And because mostly our negotiators were coming from Cape Town, you know, also aligning flights for people to be in here.
Yeah.
Then there was a lot of back and forth. Is this thing going to be only the DA and the ANC? And the conversation then evolved into the ANC, including other parties. But I think the interesting thing that I think you were also getting to is, when does it eventually the call gets made that, yes, you know, you get into government.
So did you have to put your hand up to say, in the event that there's an available position for a minister, I am available? Or does the party say, these are our strong people, these are the names we're putting forward?
So you don't put up your hand.
Okay.
Yeah. Some people, and it's very interesting because in politics, you can put up your hand without raising it.
Yes.
You know, fraternize to the leader or the key, and then have other people doing your bidding. But in our case, we give whoever is the leader of the party to make key decisions.
Okay.
Then those key decisions have to be ratified by our senior decision-making body, which is called the Federal Executive.
Mm-hmm.
So the leader had, in this case, John Steenhuisen, had the prerogative of identifying people that he thought would make a good showing for the DA then government.
Mm.
Obviously present those people to the president of the country.
Yeah.
For their formal appointment. But it was very interesting that, and too many people have asked me this, did you get a call from the president?
Yeah.
No, you didn't. It was a very interesting thing.
Mm.
The call comes from John.
Sure.
To say, look, I need your CV.
Mm.
And he was also careful in his words, because in politics, things can change at the very 11th hour. We are considering you into our team that's going to cabinet in order to give the president a sense of the individual and what they are qualified in. Let's have your resume and we submit those. When it was clear that the president would be speaking on Sunday night, announcing the cabinet, I then got a call from John on Saturday.
Mm.
On Saturday evening, I was speaking at a DA Young Leaders event and got so many missed calls. And it's never a good thing when you get so many missed calls from your party leader.
Absolutely.
So I was scared to call. So I texted. You know, he was like, "Okay, the president might be making an announcement tomorrow."
Why were you scared to call?
Because when you are in the background and you are involved in terms of the discussions, right, there are two likely outcomes at that stage.
Yeah.
That one, you know your name was in the pool.
Sure.
It could be negative, which comes with a degree of disappointment. If it happens, it's the anxiety of which portfolio is it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and no matter how much you prepare for that moment, you can never be ready for when it actually happens.
Absolutely.
I've been an opposition member of parliament for 10 years.
Mm.
Prior to that, I've been a political staffer for a mayor in Cape Town and an MEC, you know, for 6 years.
Mm.
So getting into government for anyone who has spent time in opposition, it's basically the culmination of political aspirations.
Ah, yes.
So when it sinks in, it's a realization that not only is your life going to change now, but you've got a far bigger responsibility now,
mm-hmm.
because you've got a very important job. And for us, as the first generation of DA leaders who are in national government, I think we've got additional pressure to succeed.
Yeah, you have one job. Don't mess it up.
Yeah, don't mess it up, because this is a historic phase in South Africa's history.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't do it well, what history will remember is the very first government of national unity, you know, was let down by people like Busoli.
Sure.
And that can't be the legacy that we leave.
What do you say to people who say the GNU is power sharing purely to weaken real opposition, and also it's survival for you guys? Is it really about the people? What do you say to people who argue that?
Look, I think people are always going to be cynical when two major parties get together and work together.
But you understand why, though?
I understand why.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't agree with that sentiment.
Yeah.
I understand why. And now, having seen also, and this is not shade at all, having seen the caliber of opposition, then they couldn't be so wrong. They couldn't be so wrong.
Anyway, so the phone call comes. Where were you? Like, when you eventually confirmed that, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
I'm officially sleeping with the enemy.
I was in Stellenbosch. I forget that place. It's a place where the DA has an annual retreat for our young leaders program.
Okay.
I was at that venue. And as I said to you, you know, I got missed calls from John, so I texted, and then he said, "Can you take a call?" Then I went out. Mm. It was a very brief call.
Yeah.
You know, we're putting you forward for Minister of Communications and Digital Technologies. Keep it under wraps until the president announces. Mm. Nothing is confirmed.
And then he goes and says, "Baby, guess what?"
And then you're like, "Oh shit," you know.
Yeah.
And I think that evening I was just waiting for that engagement to finish,
yeah,
go back into my hotel room. And I, you know, I did text my wife and say, "Hey, this could happen, but until it happens, nothing happens."
Yeah. And then she says to Bomma, "Bomma, yeah, guess what?"
As to what happens after that, I don't know what happens. You know, and even to my aunt, who's my mother,
yeah,
I was just like, "Okay, tomorrow around 8, I may update you, but the DA looks like it's going to be in government and I'll play a role in there." And also because, you know, particularly with parents, mm-hmm, you also have to be careful in managing their expectations.
Ah, yes.
You know, because when then it doesn't happen,
yeah,
their characterization is going to be different.
Exactly.
At least you have an understanding that, you know, things are always volatile and evolving in politics.
Mm.
Yeah.
How does one prepare close friends and family for the career path you've chosen? Because unfortunately, they automatically get into the firing line.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate,
yeah,
because no one in my family has an interest in politics, mm, other than voting and,
sure,
showing up support. But, you know, when milestones happen, mm, in one's life, people are proud, people get excited. And for me, I think because of who I am, my family thinks I'm a very strict person, so I'd always, you know, prepared for them, particularly interactions with the media. Mm. You know, and we had a very rude awakening post that announcement. A media house rocks up at my family home.
Yeah.
And they want to do an interview,
mm,
right? My uncle who...
So family home where? In Limpopo?
In Limpopo, yeah, okay, in Polokwane.
Okay.
My uncle, in a panic, then calls me, right, yeah, to say, "There are people here who want to interview us about you. Have they spoken to you?"
Mm.
I was like, "No, they haven't spoken to me." And why are they even taking shots of, you know, the house and the gate? Because my house is, you know, directly opposite my family home.
Exactly.
Right? And he was very strict. In fact, he chased them away, mm, right? And when I eventually find out which media house it is and then, you know, called their head of news, they are like, "Yeah, we're doing a profile piece." But I'm like, "You're invading other people's privacy, mm, you know, mm, that aren't part of this journey." So I think it's also the openness with people around you.
Sure.
And taking them along through that journey, because it's important for them to, in fact, even for you to understand that you are inviting the world not only into your own, you know, life, but the people around you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So this podcast is called What a Week.
Yeah.
And often we also look at things happening that week and, you know, the various stories in the headlines that we'd like to drag you into,
yeah,
or get your opinions on. And I think we can't not talk about Budgetgate.
Yes.
And the mess that became Budgetgate.
Yeah.
Before we talk about the finer details, should Minister Godongwana resign? In your humble opinion?
In my humble opinion, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to have credibility in this role going forward.
Is that a yes?
Based on, look, he's a colleague, so and I don't want to be politically correct.
Okay.
I don't want to be politically correct, but I think the episode itself, his life is complicated in that way.
Mm.
You know, I don't want to be inconsiderate to a colleague,
sure,
but it was handled wrongly from the onset, and it was avoidable. And when those things happen, if someone doesn't take a decision to reflect,
sure,
whoever is their boss must make the decision for them.
How would you have advised him to have handled this differently? Were you close friends?
Look, the unfortunate thing about the insertion of the VAT increase, right, is that it seemed as if the opposition to it, right, the opposition to a no VAT increase was purely based on who is opposing it,
yes,
rather than the substance,
mm,
you know, because 6 weeks later, we are at the position that, you know, the DA advised in the first instance. And this is not a triumphalist moment,
sure.
You know, even for my party as the DA.
If anything, it's sad that 6 weeks were wasted.
Yeah, 6 weeks wasted. And what you have done in the process is polarize, you know, allies in a government of national unity. And that's the regrettable thing, and created unnecessary uncertainty. You've had businesses making communication about, you know, VAT increases, then withdrawing them. And the most important thing in this phase that we are in is that people have to get used to the idea that old methods that worked when they were governing alone can no longer be applicable in this case, because you're governing with other people that will have opinions, that will have solutions. And we will use our muscle to then influence those, because we have to own government decisions,
sure.
Right? And I truly hope that, you know, particularly for our colleagues in the ANC, will then look at the spirit of genuinely listening to all the parties in the GNU when we make contributions. Because it was clear from the onset that any sort of VAT increase, whether it's 0.5, 1% or 2%, is going to face stern opposition in the country. And absolutely, we could have avoided that.
Do you think the ANC got so comfortable with always being the majority party, the party in government, it's our budget, we're going to pass it, that now having to collaborate is a bit of a difficult pill to swallow, or we refuse to accept the fact that we're not Miss Party anymore?
Look, I think it's a struggle to accept that things have changed.
Sure.
Right? And secondly, that you have to do uncomfortable things. Excuse me. Which is negotiate with the parties that are governing with you. That's point number one. Secondly, is there are some people in the ANC who the idea of power sharing has never been imaginable in their vocabulary. And the fact that for some, even sharing power with the DA so prominently is something that they reluctantly embrace, but deep down, if they had to have their individual choices, they wouldn't want to do that. So that then manifests itself into unnecessary impasses, unnecessary conflicts over this thing. And you know what? It's really a humbling thing to accept that. And some of their leaders publicly say this, you know, that, you know, we have to act like a party that has lost power. But to do that on a daily basis is difficult for some of them.
Yeah, because some would argue you've literally almost been emasculated.
Yeah.
But you must still walk with the pride of, this is still my home. Even when you're sharing the home.
Yeah. And perhaps it's no longer your home alone.
Exactly.
You know, that's the reality that people need to accept.
What would you say the lesson is in all of this budget gate?
I think there are two lessons. One is, in my view, the two biggest parties, the DA and the ANC, need to constantly be talking to each other about the relationship management.
Sure.
Right? Any marriage does not purely succeed because there is a declaration of commitment to that marriage. You know, it requires, you know, going on vacation, it requires buying each other flowers, going on dates. And that thing is the uncomfortable thing, because it requires sacrificing time to make time for each other.
Exactly.
And secondly is, any political calendar has major developments, the budget, the state of the nation address, the medium-term development policy. And then across portfolios, there are very prominent issues that we know historically as parties who have been on opposite sides of each other.
Sure.
There is a determination to say, okay, let's work towards a solution to those, because everything has to be negotiated. And it doesn't mean that you then find the answer in the first conversation.
Sure.
It has to be relentless. So for me, the major lessons are those two.
Absolutely. Another big story this week is Democratic South Africa turning 31 years old.
Yeah.
What are your reflections on the past 31 years?
I get saddened when I reflect on it, right? Because in 1994, I was 9 years old. In fact, when the election happens, I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
I remember taking, you know, a lunchbox from our family home to go and give my grandmother, who was in a very, very long queue outside what would later become my high school, to cast her vote. And the mood, it was a celebratory mood. And I think that celebratory mood was in anticipation that life will truly get better, right? And that a government, a democratically elected government, would rise to the occasion of serving all the people. And being part of government now, one of my earliest discoveries, which bothers me every day as I go to sleep, is what a missed opportunity, you know, we have. And that is aggravated by the fact that if there was no corruption, if there was no self-interest, if there was no, you know, tolerance of incompetence, our country would be so far. Our country would be so far.
It should be flying.
And interfacing with this every day, French, is, you know, it's heartbreaking. Because there are people who have built, and some of them are public servants, who have built their lives around cheating the state, right? And then they meet an eager, and I'm not generalizing, you know, there is components of the business world that, you know, contaminates politicians and public servants. And in that trinity, the actions of that trinity is robbing the country of its true potential. And that for me calls for, and that's why I am in politics, right? I'm in politics because I believe that the way in which the negative elements have contaminated what public service is means that solid individuals are now discouraged, you know, from taking an active role in politics out of fear of, you know, their careers being blemished or being bullied or simply being overpowered by the negative forces that are still in charge of the state.
Has the horse bolted, or can it still be brought back to the stable?
I think it can still be brought back to the stable. And I don't say this to portray, you know, me and my fellow colleagues as messiahs during this time. But I think we can't give up on our country. And I think across the board, there is a generation of really emerging leaders in civil society, in politics, and in business, who, in my view, represent, you know, the right attributes to help redirect South Africa towards, you know, that dream of what a successful rainbow nation is. And when I think about that and I see strides that, you know, some people in the NGO sector and even in our politics, it gives me hope that, you know, the good doers have to be relentless in trying to instill the right way of doing politics. Because the West would be, you know, succumbing to the people that initiated state capture and meant that service delivery in South Africa is non-existent.
Now, you've been a part of the DA's Young Leader Program for, you know, probably since inception, since like the mid-2000s.
Yes, yes.
In the mid-2000s, a lot of young black men your age were trying to get into other political parties or into other positions. But you were clear from the get-go that it's the DA that I want to be a part of.
Yeah.
take us through that thought process where chances are other men your age were, come on, comrade.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or gidi brale ma comrade. And that's the path you're taking.
Yeah.
But you jumped straight into the DA.
And I was at the capital of, you know, that type of politics, being the University of Limpopo.
Absolutely.
You know. So for me, I grew up in a village just outside the, nearby the University of Limpopo, at a place called Radihali, where for me, it's always interesting when I reflect back at that, because I was born in Shawela in Soweto, spent the first 6 years of my life there. So I think I had a sense of what basic service delivery is.
Yeah.
And then you grow up in the village where the tar roads ends 5.5 kilometers to your doorstep, right? Where people have to go to the communal tap to get water, where the only, you know, recreational facility is one soccer field in every village, right? And I think also as someone who I lost my mom when I was very young, right? And the circumstances of her death, you know, still remain a mystery to this day. So it was a crime that has never been solved. So you grow with that injustice, right? And seeking to pursue justice by, you know, having people access water, having victims of crime, finding answers so that they find closure. So when I went to the University of Limpopo, my focus was get in, get out quickly, because my sister is less than 2 years younger than me. So the family has to ensure that another person goes to varsity. But during my stay at varsity, I, you know, because I did study politics as an extra module, in my final year, I focused a lot on the future of opposition politics on the African continent as a way of strengthening democracy, because a trend was emerging then based on what happened in, you know, Central Africa and coming down Southern Africa about the danger of one-party state.
Yeah.
So I think indirectly, that meant that I'd never had any spiritual attachment to the ANC, you know, at all. In fact, I will confess, I voted for PASMA when I was at the University of Limpopo, you know, which is a PAC student league, and only because those guys really fought for students to be registered, regardless of, you know, their financial standing. So I voted for PASMA. So what brought me closer to the DA was in my final year when I was looking at what strengthens democracy is having strong opposition. Because back then it was clear the DA, you know, would not be in government, you know, for the next two decades. And the more I made an effort to meet DA leaders, to interact with the DA, a resonance on the ideals and the values of the organization became much stronger.
So how did you deal with the pushback from other black men your age? Because obviously that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You think you're better than us.
You know, it's...
No, he's a minister now. Anyway, yeah, you were saying.
No, it's very interesting. And I just have an ability to block the noise and just focus on what I think is right for me, right? Was it easy? No, it wasn't easy. But it's like the trolls, you know. If I took everything to heart that a faceless person says on Twitter, I'll be permanently unhappy, right? And for me, it was also the sake that way, because communities and societies are intolerant of difference. You know, because people are so acclimatized to normalcy, and people are abiding by, you know, a certain set of norms and values that have been imposed by other people. I think it was hard for my family to hear those things rather than for me to hear them, because for me, I was like, it comes with the territory. And, you know, if the worst you can say is that and not my ideas, then shame on you, not me.
Another big story in the news over the last week or two, I mean, you speak about the death of your mother and how you don't have closure because there are still unanswered questions. One of the big stories over the last couple of weeks has been the death of Jose Albert Luthuli. What are your thoughts on that process?
Sure. Look, justice has to be done. That's, as you know, someone who knows the weight, you know, of trying to find closure. I think the right thing for not only the family, the Luthuli family, but the organization he belonged to and everyone who revered him and held him highly is for the actual truth to emerge in that. It's very important for healing and it's very important also for forgiveness.
Absolutely. Another big story this week, President Trump's first 100 days. You can pick one of them. All of them have been dramatic. What are your thoughts? I mean, you know, obviously he got re-elected last year.
Yeah.
What's the first thing that came to mind when you heard that he's coming back?
It's going to... I was like, this is going to go down now. Like, because anyone who gets re-elected...
Sure.
Particularly after an unsuccessful attempt, right, feels they have unfinished business,
yes,
naturally. And I think what we are seeing now is a determination to leave a very strong legacy for him, and he feels this is the only chance to do what he actually has been wanting to do. And he's doing it in a global stage, you know. His methods, unconventional. And probably, you know, in the interest, because I think the world has looked up to America as the world's oldest democracy for exemplary conduct in many ways, from diplomacy, you know, trade relations, you know, pursuing peace in the international stage, supporting developing countries. And what we are seeing makes people actually have a different view of of the role that America should be playing globally.
What are your views on how the South African government has responded to the Trump administration? Because some argue that why do you still knock on a door that is not being answered? Why are you running after the girl that doesn't want to date you anymore? What are your thoughts on how South Africa's handled the Trump administration?
Look, I think it's the right approach.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I don't think South Africa can afford to take an antagonistic or hostile position towards America. And this has nothing to do with America's strength or you know, strong arm approach to certain matters, but more about South Africa's always positioned itself, you know, as also a leader in the international stage, particularly around reconciliation, right? Particularly about support for developing countries. And I think, you know, given what we symbolize as a country towards democracy and what America historically symbolizes for democracy, we are supposed to be natural allies, you know, in advancing peace in the world, in advancing, you know, international trade and development, upholding human rights. And I think we are at a stage where in now, South Africa, because of also the pressure of geopolitics, has to be very, very careful in how we want to have a relationship with the US and what kind of relationship. I'm still of the view that we still need a mutually, you know, beneficial relationship with the US. And basically what the Trump administration is positioning itself for is for some deal with South Africa.
Sure.
So it is up to the South African government, which I'm part of, to then say, okay, what kind of deal can we live with that we can present to America? Because international cooperation and diplomacy is about mutually acceptable deals, you know, and that's the real politic of this world.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So Canada have a brand new prime minister.
Yeah.
And Canada, you know, from the beginning of the first 100, the first day of the Trump administration, they've been pushing back. Mexico have been pushing back. China have been pushing back. What are your views on some of these pushback strategies and responses from some of these nations?
Look, I think especially with new governments that emerge post-Trump and particularly post the traffic imposition, you're going to see a lot of what I call, you know, muscle diplomacy with people, you know, to use the millennial word, flexing their muscle in international relations. My view is that no country in the international stage can be an island, right? And no matter how wealthy, no matter how strong you are, or no matter how ambitious you are, you eventually need to work with other countries and not isolate the superpowers, and not out of fear, but on the reality of what advances our political and economic interest in pursuing a relationship with the US or China or Russia, and what values guides those relationships. And you know what? I think what often, you know, dilutes diplomacy is the egos of the big men in politics, right? Because if you strip away that, you'd find that diplomats in international fora like the United Nations, European Commission, and all these other international bodies are still able to get along on the basis of, you know, historical country cooperations. And I think what the temperature of international relations dictates at this stage is to look beyond the egos of whoever is the president of that country and say, how do we best advance our national interest with a country that might be reviewing our relationship? Because there's also a lot of dependence, particularly on developing countries' part, a sense of entitlement to international aid that has previously been provided there. And now, because somebody is resetting the terms of those conditions, we then feel had done.
Or play victim.
Exactly.
When we've had those 20 years to actually find a plan that has us not going with the begging hats to other nations.
Yeah, and also reposition, you know, our stature.
Yes.
Because, you know, South Africa in 2025 is not the same country it was in 1994, and our needs are different, right?
Yeah.
We also have different leaders. The same for Canada, Mexico, Botswana, or Lesotho. So it's also, you know, because a lot of countries, we want to have international influence, but we also don't want to let go of international dependencies.
Yes.
So it's kind of like an oxymoron.
Absolutely. One of the issues that we discussed on this podcast with Botsang on our Politrix segment was reimagining our education system.
Yeah.
Where we're not just teaching children to regurgitate stuff that they've read, but that you're teaching real skills. You're empowering kids to leave high school, being able to live, to make a living. You know, whether it's when you leave high school, you've got a driver's license already. When you leave high school, you can service your own car. There's so many low-hanging fruit that we are failing to pick in how we can empower kids to leave school able to do stuff.
Yeah, and that touches on multiple layers, because
I'd like my daughter to leave high school being able to do her own taxes, being able to put together a basic balance sheet. But our kids are leaving high school just ready to work for someone.
Yeah, and ready to learn, not even work.
Yes.
You know, because if you then look in terms of the absorption rate of, you know, post matriculants into the workforce, it's retail. You know, it's low skilled work, right? But the reality is, we're living in an era where the nature of livelihoods has changed significantly, and there's also a recognition that not every young person who passes matric, for instance, you know, can be absorbed by a higher tertiary, you know, ecosystem. Because even there is an oversupply of learners vis-a-vis spaces available at institutions. And I think the missing link, as you correctly identified, is the balance of the technical skills that prepare young people to be able to support themselves post-work. And also, in the current landscape, how does government strategically identify industries that can encourage people to earn a living,
yes.
you know, on those. And part of that relates to also the work that I'm doing on the digital economy. To say that, you know, the future of work has changed.
Yeah.
Right, work has become more remote, and in the communication sphere, the opportunities that are there in the digital space are so immense. So we have to look at, particularly from my point as a government, whether on platforms, how do we take actions that empower South Africans to be on these platforms but earn a living, particularly where there is provision in other parts of the world, as is the case of TikTok, for instance.
In fact, that was going to be my next question, because I know that for the last couple of weeks you've been talking about how, yes, you know, South African TikTokers might be able to make a bit of money through brand sponsorships and TikTok Live, but they're excluded from TikTok's creator fund.
Yeah.
And that's where they can make real money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm very passionate about that thing. And I've met TikTok twice.
Yeah. Did they make you do a challenge?
No. Yeah.
I was waiting to see you, Jaiva.
No. I would never do that.
With a cat or something.
No. It would make for a comical affair, but negatively so. I would never want to do anything with dancing.
Yeah.
My view is that you know, TikTok's claims that the Creator Fund is only in place in 6 countries, I think the US, China, and some parts of Europe,
right? Yeah.
And that they are testing it in those markets. So therefore, South Africa is not excluded, right?
Yeah.
My obligation is to South Africa, not other parts of the world.
Absolutely.
Right? South Africa is one of the largest TikTok markets in the world.
Mm.
And if you look at the influence that we've also had in terms of influencing, you know, beyond even pop culture, entertainment, creativity on internet, on TikTok, it's massive. Therefore, we are a fertile ground, you know, particularly on the African continent for the expansion of this Creator Fund, because we have to be fair. And for me, this is a matter of economic justice, right? More than, you know, a cool thing to have for our creators, because these platforms make a lot of money off the creative work of our creatives and our digital content creators. Therefore, I'm going to push with everything I have to make sure that we get justice for our content creators.
You've had 2 meetings with TikTok.
Yeah.
What happened at the first one that you needed a second one?
So at the first one was highlighting that there is a brewing movement in South Africa, right, of displeasure around the fact that our content creators are not justly remunerated for their work. The second meeting was I got invited to one of their summits, and I took the pleasure of using their platform to say that as South African, as the Minister of Communications, this is one of my obsessions. And I kid you not, Fresh, I'm going to be pushing if it means also...
But what are they saying that we need to push?
Well, you know, they're saying that we are testing this in the other markets and that...
So test it here.
That's my view. And they claim, and I don't want to speak on their behalf also, you know, I don't want to speak on their behalf. But I mean, for me, their argument doesn't hold water in that... They claim there is sufficient in the current reward system for our content creators to make enough of a living. But there's still the disparity between what is applicable in the US, in parts of Asia, and Europe. And if for me it means, and I've already started speaking to some of the ministers on the African continent, that you know, we need to organize ourselves in exerting pressure on TikTok.
Maybe you need to take a leaf from the book of Donald Trump and be very hardline about it.
Yeah.
There'll be no TikTok in South Africa anymore.
Look.
Maybe that's where you need to go.
That would be the extreme.
Yes, sir.
That would be the extreme. I believe that extreme interventions become the last resort.
Sure.
Yeah.
And more often than not, people then just shut off.
Yeah. You know. And we have, and I think there's a recognition, no one in their right mind can deny the fact that it is injustice that you have a reward system that is applicable in other parts of the world, but you don't have it in markets that are almost the same size, but on a different continent. And I don't think that an institution like TikTok would want to live with the burden of perpetuating, you know, economic inequality.
I was going to say, because there's almost a tinge of imperialism, the Africans, so let's give them the scraps and let's give the so-called more developed markets the bigger piece of the pie.
And hence I make the point that I don't think the senior leadership of TikTok would want to look at this and live with the stain of perpetuating economic inequality in the digital space, because that would be far more costly for them rather than opening up the way for the creator fund to be in here. Because you know what happens when societies feel that they need to fight against inequality. You know, it leads to disruptive actions. And I hope that, you know, the penny drops to realize they've got a golden opportunity. They've got a golden opportunity to say that, you know, one, as a part of a commitment to making sure that there's economic fairness, let's extend this.
Let's do what is right.
Yeah, let's do what is right.
That's all.
And for me, the advocacy is start here in South Africa.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A massive story this week has been the MacG Mini Dlamini story, where MacG sadly and unfortunately decided to body shame Mini in a way that I never thought I'd hear anything like this on any medium anywhere on the planet. And MacG is my boy. I love him to death, but I don't know that I can sit and say what he did should be allowed it's not right.
Totally unacceptable.
But let's get into where I want to go, though. You were tweeted by Kusela Diko.
Yeah.
And she says, "We will be called all manner of names when Parliament pushes for the regulation of podcasting, but the attack on Mini Dlamini is simply not it. It's misogynistic, hurtful, and has no place in our society. What avenue for recourse does she and many other people who have suffered at the hands of these anything-goes platforms? At least licensed broadcasters have a responsibility to account to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission. Here on these platforms, nothing, unless you have the financial muscle to litigate, which is a privilege not everyone enjoys. I hope this matter is in your very full in-tray, Minister Solly Malatsi." You saw the tweet, right?
Yeah, I saw the tweet.
Yeah.
Look, and let's start with addressing, you know, the MacG sentiments, which in a country that has and continues to battle with gender-based violence, in a country that continues to battle with gender inequality, to have not only a, you know, podcaster, a prominent podcaster, perpetuating that vile attack on the dignity of women is totally unacceptable. The second point is that broadcasters have a responsibility to empower their audiences, right? To empower their audiences with information and the right way of doing things. A lot of entertainers discard their responsibility for that under the veil that, oh, we are just there to entertain. That is nonsense. The third point I want to make is that traditional media has evolved, right? Has evolved to the extent that the structures that are there that look after ethical conduct and responsible broadcasting are not currently applicable in the podcasting space. That leaves a wide gap. It leaves a wide gap for this kind of unwarranted attacks on people and their dignity. And I think that it is the right thing, and we will be kicking off the process of looking how do we best ensure that we set up at least a structure that can give audiences the right to seek recourse when their dignity has been hurt by podcasters, and also when misinformation and fake news are spread to those platforms, because the Broadcasting Complaints Commission wouldn't be the right instrument in this instance. But my view is that we can't afford to continue with a space where there is no authoritative body that looks over responsible broadcasting of podcasting.
What do you say to people who argue that, but there's always a recourse? I mean, there's already the Cybercrime Act that could kick into place if what you're posting, for instance, on social media, and podcasting would take it as a cyber act. That you have that in your favor. You can literally take a clip and go to a police station and say, this there was said here, injured me in such and such a manner, and open a police case and kickstart that process.
Yeah.
What do you say to people who say there's processes already, but maybe now we're calling for things to go back to the apartheid era, where we want to police people so much that your freedom of speech becomes nothing?
No. Freedom of speech comes with responsibility.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. So I think there are two things, and that's where I think the portfolio committee chairperson is right about that, you know, the current instruments leaves it for litigation, which is, you know, an available instrument to those who are privileged enough to have the means and the resources, right? They're invoking the cyber acts also is a practical step of doing it. But what we need is to tighten the gap.
Okay.
You know, tighten the gap from the criminal element of it and the social responsibility aspect of it, so that there is no loophole. There is no loophole. I'm not a big fan of over-regulation, you know, because you then stifle, stifle creativity, stifle industries.
And but it's a slippery slope, because then when is it, because I'm offended, I want it to happen, that we regulate certain things. But where do we draw the line between regulation and we're now Nazis?
Yes. And I think it's very key thing that offense on its own can be the only barometer.
Absolutely.
Of measuring injustice.
Absolutely.
And that's why we need to clearly define that, you know, in a very fair and balanced way. But we can't fresh have it an open season where, you know, if I don't like you, I've got beef with you, I can go in any podcast and say the most outrageous of things. And if 10 other people do that and you want to, you know, lay, you know, those 10 charges, they're going to exhaust you. And at that time, you are carrying the injustice. And no matter how many times we appeal for people's moral values to take over, some of these individuals are just loose cannons who have no regard for other people's values and respect.
What do you say to people who then argue that podcasting is an opt-in a medium? It's not a broadcast per se. And that those that don't like the podcast should not opt into the podcast. Then they don't have to consume that media.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that, you know, whatever is being consumed by that audience you are not part of won't spread to the rest of the world. And it can be that, you know, offense should only be taken by subscribers or those who tune into it. No, I don't believe that that holds water. I think there is a recognition that, you know, the rise of podcasting has introduced, you know, a new dimension towards multimedia that we need to look very, very carefully about how it does not contribute to the negative elements that, that we are seeing in society, around misinformation, fake news, and just being spreaders of vile nonsense.
So there's also cancel culture on top of everything that we're talking about. What are your views on cancel culture? So, for instance, the big call this week has been cancel MacG, cancel MacG. And for instance, for me personally, I don't agree with the things he said, and like you're saying, they were very vile. But I will never call for anyone to be cancelled, because I don't believe we should throw people away. We should show people another way and try and convince them of that other way. But personally, for me, I think cancel culture is very it's very knee-jerk. It's very myopic, and says that we might as well cancel your uncle that was sent to jail for whatever, because we're now throwing people away because we don't agree with them or we think they're vile.
Yeah. I believe genuine mistakes happen.
Yeah.
I believe that other mistakes happen because people are ignorant.
Mm.
And I believe that if you cancel everyone,
mm.
you then lose an opportunity to positively influence people to see, you know, their wrong ways.
Absolutely.
And as a result, you don't effect the change that you ultimately want to see in society. Mm. So I am not an advocate for cancel culture.
Mm.
I feel like, you know, if we take the permanent approach of canceling each other out,
mm.
then we are going to end up in a permanent standoff, you know, in the universe.
Mm.
I will always believe in the power of persuasion,
mm.
but there has to be a line also.
Mm.
There has to be that line, because unfortunately the reality of, you know, human nature is that other people are lost causes,
mm.
and therefore that's when you can trigger other instruments,
mm.
you know,
mm.
And those can be legal instruments that gag people, mm. if needs be.
Absolutely. What's your favorite podcast right now?
I don't watch a lot of podcasts.
Mm.
You know, I don't watch a lot of podcasts, but there is one on, I just forgot the host, on mindfulness,
mm.
That I embraced over 3 years ago. I think a friend of mine, Dean Chips, recommended it. And, you know, once a week I tune into it. It's basically wherein, you know, highly successful people from business, academia, and sports talk about the power of, you know, mindfulness and being present,
mm.
That I find useful, particularly even doing in this role where your mind is focused on a million little pieces,
yes.
at once,
mm.
and one needs to constantly make time,
mm.
To guard your center. You know, otherwise you just end up being pulled in different directions.
Mm, mm. Minister, we are running out of time.
Yeah.
I'm going to need us to wrap up. I want to wrap up with certain things this week that, yeah. happened in your life. What was your biggest challenge this week?
Hey, I've got a 2-year-old son, my guy. Yes. Yeah.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Hey, I've got a 2-year-old son. Ah, the guy doesn't sleep.
Yeah.
You know, look. He doesn't make me sleep. He sleeps,
yes.
but he doesn't make me sleep.
Ah, yes.
He's got his feet on my face, on, mm. my chest, and I sleep very late.
Sure.
So I get to bed around, you know, 11:30 or midnight,
mm.
and I think that's when he's in his comfort zone.
Sure.
But then it means, hey, man, I am at the mercy of a 2-year-old, healthy,
mm.
Bubbly and energetic kid, and I'm like, my guy, I just need one extra hour of sleep.
Yeah.
You know? And this week has been on his worst behavior.
No, he's 2, so good luck.
Yeah, I know.
It's gonna carry. How many kids do you have?
I have 1.
Yeah, okay.
And not only one I know of, I absolutely have 1. Absolutely.
Categorically, there aren't any others.
I have 1. Without any fear of contradiction.
Mrs. Minister, we hope you're listening. There's only 1. Do you plan to have more? Would you like to have more?
I believe that every kid deserves a sibling.
Sure.
You know, I just think that being the only kid, you know, robs a kid of, you know, the joy of an immediate community, you know,
sure.
that community being the family. Maybe it's because I come from a very big family. So, of course, yes, I'd love, mm. to have another one. But as you know, that's not a conversation for me alone.
Absolutely. You know? It's, yeah. not a one-man show.
No, it's not.
Biggest achievement this week?
Biggest achievement this week would be going through my to-do list.
Yeah.
You know, I think the disruption of the long weekends and the Easter weekend, you know, one has been deferring, you know, work stuff and even, yeah. some personal stuff, but just clearing my to-do list has been very liberating, kind of like make me feel I'm being productive again.
In fact, I'm looking at your tweet from this week, the week that was, I delivered keynote at SATA 45, engaged with platforms to support SA creators, attended portfolio oversight committee, engaged the media on G20 and tech entrepreneurship. Until next time, let's stay connected. How important is it for you to also update us on your goings on at your department? Yeah.
I think it's very important. One, because a lot of people have no idea what ministers do on a day-to-day basis.
What do deputy ministers do?
They deputize ministers. But they are also, they are all, in my case, my deputy minister has got a fair chunk of responsibilities looking after the South African Post Office, the Post Bank, and also our commitments on the continent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're still telling us about updates for the
UK? Yeah. I think it's very important for people to have a genuine sense of what ministers do on a day-to-day basis. And I've taken the approach that particularly in, for young ministers, it's important to showcase that, you know, I mean, there is a mischaracterization that ministers and politicians are, you know, useless, they are lazy, fat cats, they don't know what they are doing. So the purpose of my weekly newsletter is to share with the public in a transparent manner the work that we are doing on a day-by-day basis in order for them to make a determination that you are working or you are not working.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're spanning more.
Yeah, you know, it's not just about, you know, going to cabinet meetings and seeming busy, because that's the other thing. You can seem busy and not productive.
You know, I know it might be a chicken and an egg situation, but how much of it is, I want to update you guys, but how much of it is also, I want you to guys see that I'm working because there's an election coming?
There's an election every 2 years, every 5 years. I think I just took a decision when I got into this that it is very important to communicate with the voters and the South African public, right? Regardless of whether an election is there. And I must say, this particular newsletter was inspired by the work that my brother in Nigeria, the Minister of ICT, is doing, because I looked at the work that he was doing and I found it informative.
Sure.
And I was like, this will empower people in understanding what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
And as a communicator, it's always important to communicate what you're working on.
This week in your life, what was your gratitude moment this week? Or your biggest gratitude moment?
Yeah. I was able to do all the things that I love, right? My family, they are in good health. And I was able to visit my mother's grave. I was able to spend time with the young people of my soccer club in Limpopo. I've got a football team in Polokwane. And just an appreciation that a young man like me, fresh from Polokwane in an obscure village, is healthy, is having a healthy family, and has this important job at this time in our country, I'm permanently grateful for it.
What's your soccer team's name?
Makakang Karekaofela.
Does that fit on the jersey? Or
It does. Bottom, top and bottom.
Yes.
It does.
Why did you choose to get involved in a soccer team?
So I played football. I wasn't very good at it.
But you've got the build, though.
I later discovered my build is for long distance running rather than football. I played football because there was only a soccer field.
There was nothing else to do.
There was nothing else.
Yeah.
And I tried track and field in primary, but I was slow. And also, I think the embarrassment of being out-sprinted by my younger sister.
Sure.
So I was like, you know, focus on disky. I decided to have a soccer club because when I was young, our community football team did not have support from anyone. Makhrotma Nakasi were not interested in it. And when I got into my 20s, I had nephews. They were 8, 9. And a friend of mine was also in the same position. And we realized that if we don't set up and revive the football team, we're going to lose this kid to the negative role models.
Absolutely.
Because the positive role models, what do they do, Fresh? They live out they leave out of their casis and go and settle elsewhere. And we leave these kids, you know, in the hands of vultures.
Sure.
But they are present. So people look up to those. And I've seen the power of sport and opportunities in giving people hope about a better chance for life.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You're proud to be South African moment this week.
My proud to be South African moment. I think a celebration of Human Rights Day, right? Because it is, I think sometimes a lot of people don't fully appreciate what a difficult road it was to get South Africa to freedom and democracy. And these holidays get reduced to doing nothing.
Yes.
Right? Instead of a moment of reflection, and a renewal of what can we individually do to keep trying to make South Africa a better place as those who came and fought and lost their lives for it. So that for me is a proud South African moment, because there are those people who still uphold that.
In closing, do you think you guys will ever get more than 50% at the polls? And what do you think it will take for the DA to get more than 50% at the polls?
More than 50% of the vote?
Or is it a pipe dream?
It's very ambitious.
Yeah.
I would say majority to be in government, because you don't need 50% to have a majority to be in government. I think it's realistic for the DA to get a sufficient majority to lead a government. The reality is that the future of governing is going to be coalitions.
Yes.
So it's a matter of who becomes the big party in that coalition. And I think based on our performance in the GNU and the forecast of South Africa's future, you know, within the next 10 years, we should be able to be the largest party in any coalition government nationally.
The DA has been accused of struggling to win the trust of the black majority.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is it perception?
Look, I think the reality is we haven't grown as much as we wanted to do amongst black voters.
True.
And that is attributable to even our struggles to be, you know, the largest party in the country. But there are very interesting interesting things that happened in the last election and even in the last local election. If you look at where Chris Pappas is the mayor, Umgeni, the DA became the largest party there, and the largest percentage of voters are black. And I speak under correction. I think it was in Johannes, either Soweto or Tshwane, where in the last election we got more black votes than even the ANC got. You know, so I think as more people interface with the DA in government, that trust that perhaps wasn't historically there will start forming stronger. Because remember, outside of the metros and, you know, small municipalities like, you know, Graaf, Reneid and Umgeni, people have never experienced or felt what a DA in government looks like. We now have an opportunity with six ministers in the national government, and that will also help that. And which is why it's been very encouraging looking at some of the polls that emerged last week. There was a poll that came out which put the DA to be at approximately over 30% and as the largest political party at this moment in the country. So those are the encouraging signs for me.
When you guys meet as leadership in the DA, what kind of conversations do you have on race, on representation?
Yeah, we speak very honestly in the DA about one, you know, reconciliation, about nation building, and about race. In South Africa, particularly in politics, race is still a factor because of the history of our country and also how, you know, division in our society has been perpetuated through race. And it's never uncomfortable conversations. Mm. It's about how do we bring South Africa together, recognizing how much of a factor race was used as an instrument to divide people.
The people who look at how Musi Maimane left the DA, and other black leaders that were in the DA but now aren't. Mm. And the question often is, were they pushed? Did they jump? Who's next is Solly next? What are your thoughts on such conversations?
I have the advantage of having been close to some of the prominent people who have left the party. And I don't think they were pushed. Mm. I don't think they were pushed. Here's the thing, Fresh. I think what happens in the DA, unlike in other organizations, is a lot of talent rises to prominence and to important roles quickly. And that is not a negative, right? That is not a negative. It rises to prominent positions very quickly because we've got a very fair system of contestation for leadership and opportunities. However, politics is also about faces, right? It means that sometimes people will win conferences and other people lose conferences. And for some people, when they've lost conferences and lost their influence, then their stay becomes untenable. Mm. Whether the institution has made it uncomfortable for them, because losing an election is not easy. Mm. And also, I believe that people evolve as individuals. And when, you know, someone who was in the party, you know, decides, having spent 10 years with the party, that they don't think that they can continue and values are misaligned, I think we have to treat each and every case for its own merits than generalize. As much as it's tempting to say the outcome is all the same, these people have left and they seem to attribute some same things. But I believe that some of the people that we have lost are great political talents that would make us, you know, even stronger. And I hope that in future some of them would come back.
Is your position at the DA safe for now?
I was elected by a Congress, and I am not in the DA reluctantly.
Sure.
I'm in the DA voluntarily.
You've been there since you were a youth.
Sorry?
You've been there since you were youth.
Yes, yeah. And it's not because I couldn't be anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I made a voluntary choice to align with the DA, and it's very interesting, and I'm glad you asked that, because, you know, other people say, when are you going home? I'm like,
well, yeah, when are you coming home?
Where is home?
Yeah.
Because this has been my only political home. Yeah. You know, so yeah, I'm a leader in the DA, and I'm proud to be a leader in the DA, and I'm here to stay.
What's next for your department? Because you guys are busy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, your target is moving all the time because of technological advancements.
Yeah.
We almost need to keep up, and legislation is not keeping up.
Yes. So what's next for the department and for me, you know, in charge of the department, is we need to get South Africa to 100% internet connectivity.
Oh, yes.
I think it's a very powerful instrument of unlocking even economic opportunities for people. I think it's important that we continue with the fight, well, not a fight, with the advocacy that we've been having in government about making instruments of communication affordable. We've had a successful campaign around making smart devices affordable because, truth be told, you know, smartphones, smart tablets. In this day and age, we can't live with those.
Yeah.
You know, they've become such essential instruments to communicate in. And we've got a very interesting arrangement in South Africa where they are considered luxury goods.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've got what is called the ad valorem tax.
There should be a basic human right at this stage.
Fresh. I think that guy's job is at risk. You know, one of the things that I said upon taking this job is that smart devices should basically even be recognized in the UN Charter for Human Rights.
Absolutely.
As a basic right, because we can't function, whether for learning, for business, even for pleasure, because it's a very important aspect of making life enjoyable.
Absolutely. Are you excited about the next 5 years?
I am. Yeah. As uncertain as it is sometimes, I'm very excited about it. And as I said to you in the beginning, it's a massive honor for me to have the privilege of being a minister in the government of national unity. And the least I can do is to make sure that we succeed in this role by doing the right things and not be distracted by many of the distractions that have held South Africa back.
It's an exciting time to be alive.
It is. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
And we just need to... And by this, I mean, you know, the politicians at charge. We just need to, you know, get away from our egos and and we don't actually even need to be buddy buddies.
Sure.
We have to be pragmatic enough to say what is in the best interest of South Africa at this level and can it work, regardless of whether it's said by Soli or by a Ronald Lamola or Gayton McKenzie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always say, whether it's in divorce, in marriage, in politics, at work, we're not here to make friends.
Yeah.
What's in the best interest of the people who look to us to make sure that we deliver what is due to them? That's all.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You don't have to like me, but can we get the job done?
And do it the right way.
Absolutely.
You know, and stop being sentimental about things, because it is possible.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the discoveries with government is you realize that... there's a lot of bureaucratization of unnecessary things.
Yes.
And it's to make people feel important, but that stands in the way of action and delivery. And can we just focus on that?
And you know what the sad thing is about the bureaucratization of a lot of processes? It then creates a parallel economy. Because where there's a lot of bureaucracy, there are people willing to say, but if you give me R1,000, I'll make it go faster.
Yeah. It creates a market for nefarious things.
Absolutely.
And that market for nefarious things is very lucrative for some people.
Most departments have a parallel economy of people. Any office you go to, Gavi, wanting something, there's someone out there who can make it go faster for you. But you might just pay them.
There are people, Fresh, who have built their whole lives on robbing the state.
Yeah.
And they're very, very skilled at it, right? But for me, it takes three.
Sure.
It takes one, those who receive those things, which are the public servants, and the politicians who receive and also look for those things.
Yeah.
And three, the businesses and service providers who are willing to put these incentives in there. If we can get rid of those, we would be the level of delivery and efficiency in government would be great.
Finally, and I promise it's the last question. Yeah. Soli Malatsi is president for a year. What are you changing?
I would cut down the number of departments.
Yeah. So your deputy is gone.
Don't put words in my mouth. I would also reduce the number of government entities.
Yeah.
Right, because we are basically just, I mean, the architecture of government has just created so many boards, and we're spending lots of money paying for board fees, and those things can be incorporated back into the departments. I would make sure that every learner has access to a smart device and that in school we teach digital skills because it aligns with the work that I'm doing in my portfolio. I would also ensure that we look at ways to reduce the harmful effects of betting in our society. I think there is a silent killer that is emerging in our communities that is capturing young people into dependency on betting. And I think it's very, very unhealthy in the long run.
A lot of people think betting is the easy way out.
Yeah.
And they treat betting as if the place that you bet at are in the business of giving money away. Then the business of taking your money and giving you hope that you might make a buck.
And that destroys lives, man.
What do we do about all this betting advertising that's happening all of a sudden? Because it's everywhere. I'm seeing more betting opportunities than drinking opportunities now.
Yes. And also, like, you know, there's a difficult reconciliation that I also grapple with because you look at some of the contribution that betting companies make in sports.
Yes.
Right? And you realize that, you know, our sporting codes would be bereft of resources without those. But there's such an overwhelming overexposure to betting for even young people.
Absolutely.
And that for me is dangerous. Mm. And that needs to be relooked. You know, how do you achieve responsible betting? Mm. I think we also need to look at overexposure to those times.
Yes.
And have, you know, and a friend of mine, Mahashule Ghana, is very, very passionate about this subject. And have a dispensation wherein this concept around responsible gambling, gambling, for instance, and betting, there is far more contribution than the current 1% contributions that are being made in there. Not necessarily to be punitive, but to minimize the risks and dangers of entrapping young lives into a dependency on something elusive as betting for a reward.
I remember when you needed to travel to bet. You needed to go to a resort. You needed to go to a sun city. You needed to go to a wild coast sun. Now you just cross the road.
Yeah, and even on your phone.
And now you do it on your phone.
Yeah.
I remember when betting was your father saying, here's 5 rand, go bet on Legs of Thunder there by the horses.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays it's everywhere.
And it's very scary.
Yeah.
It's very scary. And I think the betting companies also have a responsibility to be mindful of, you know, the socioeconomic harms that they may not be fully aware that they are imposing on this generation of young people, particularly in a country grappling with high levels of unemployment. People, as you correctly said out, look at these as channels of easy money, and it's not.
It's not an economic plan.
No.
To bet.
No.
Or to play the lottery.
It's,
or to find a rich partner.
It's unsustainable. Yeah. Yes. It almost got over my head, that one. Yes. Yeah.
Minister, thank you for your time.
It's truly a pleasure.
Thank you for agreeing to hang out with us. And thanks for being the humble. You've been this humble from day one.
Thank you, man.
And as I walked in, I saw you walking in with your PA, and I don't know what the other gent does. I was like, how? No blue lights. I was so disappointed. I thought there'd be guys with big guns saying, move out of the way, the minister is here. You guys were just walking, strolling here.
Yeah, look, I think it's very important to also showcase to South African the right way of leading in government.
Yes.
And I think that is what has built a disconnect between leaders and the public.
Absolutely.
And if we can be that bridge that reinstalls, you know, faith in our leaders in government, that will be half the work done. This is a privilege. This is not entitlement. And any time this can go, but who you are as a person stays with you permanently. And my approach, as I always tell my team, is you know, be the person you are even in this role, because this role is only temporary. If the GNU collapses, it mustn't be difficult for me to bump into you working in there, you know.
Exactly.
Other people, once they no longer have those titles, you don't even see them socializing. It's like they're done off the surface of the earth.
You can't have your wife now asking, oh, and then blue light, I know.
Exactly, you know, and those things are tools of trade, you know.
Yes,
they are not entitlements, and they become distractions, quite frankly.
Yeah. Minister, ke leboga.
Go leboga nnete.
Thank you for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, please make some noise for Minister Moba.
Eish.
Is that as in Emily?
Soli Malatsi, is it?
But can we discuss Moba?
Umutwana, you know what Moba is.
Yeah, Moba is mealy.
No, it's a sugar cane.
Oh, sugar cane.
Yeah.
Okay, no, Kastwana ke nche.
Yeah, kaspedi ke Moba. And I guess the only thing I connect with that, and it used to be my lousy pickup line when I was very young, is that I'm sweet.
Ah. But if you chew long enough, I won't be.
And I'm and also I'm tall, because most sugar canes are tall. That's
absolutely
it.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, he delivers exactly the way sugar cane should. Please make some noise for Minister of Communications and Digital Technologies, Soli.
Malatsi. Coming to you from AMP Studios, downtown Johannesburg, we're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Email waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Shout out Trevor and the team for all of the cinematography. Additional production by Latty. Social media behind the scenes by YBF. And our executive producer is Keletso Modisa-King. Till next week, have a wow week in spite of yourselves.